The prescience of Philpott's letter was extraordinary, although not quite in the way he intended. The blissful state in which life and art coexisted would indeed come to an end for Agatha when her world changed so completely in 1926. After that, there would be separation. Her dreams and imaginative delights would no longer weave through the whole of her life, but only through her work. Like Vernon Dyer in her first Westmacott novel Giant's Bread, or like Pearl Craigie, whose marriage broke down hideously, Agatha would tread the hard road of art. She would become definitively a writer, and incidentally a working woman of independent means, with a life entirely transcendent of her calm and closeted upbringing. The girl who longed to marry Archie Christie foresaw nothing of this, not a shred. "I had the normal, comfortable ideas about a married life," she said in an interview almost 60 years later. And in her autobiography, she described her longing for Archie in simple terms. A young girl like any other, on the prowl for a mate, had found the man, a charming and commonplace story. But the soft, meandering prose of Unfinished Portrait shows Archie to have touched deeper nerves. He was Agatha's dream come true, in every sense, the living expression of her ineffable yearnings. Something you want so much that you don't quite know what it is. He was the unknown, the dark, the free. She fell in love with him so deeply because she sensed that life with him would be like a piece of music or a poem. She would be an Isolde, an Elaine. He kissed her face. At once, she slipped like water to the floor. The sensible part of her wanted the daily life of marriage, the housekeeping and the receipts book. But in her artist's mind, these were hallowed by the extraordinary fact of Archie himself. Such a contrast between the ordered breakfast table, folded copy of the Times, with its personal columns on the front page, polished silver teapot, Cooper's Oxford marmalade, and the man who sat behind it. Between the immaculate corners of the fresh linen bed and the mysteries that took place within. The way he looked, long and loose-limbed and unconsciously romantic, his air of doomed vulnerability, the strange purity of his desire, so unlike the practiced urgency of Bolton Fletcher. These things ranged around Agatha's imagination, which, in essence, had not grown up at all. Despite her womanly craving for Archie, something in her remained childlike. Then to her tower she climbed, and so lived in fantasy. Clara knew her daughter's nature, and intuited what Agatha saw in Archie. "That young man, I don't like him," is the thought attributed to her in Unfinished Portrait. It was not completely true, but his powerful appeal alarmed her, because she realized, as Agatha did not, that other women would see it too. He is attracted to women, Celia, remember that. However much Clara had wanted a happy marriage for Agatha, she had dreaded this kind of attachment. Reggie Lucy was one thing, Archie was quite another, and he made her fearful, for Agatha and herself. She had recognized the situation immediately when he turned up at Ashfield on his motorbike. She did not tell herself that this all might come to nothing. She believed, on the contrary, that she saw events casting their shadows before them. And it was selfishness, in a sense, that made her uneasy. To be supplanted in Agatha's affections was alarming, painful. She recognized that Archie was as strong a character as she herself was, and that he had sex on his side. Nevertheless, her sustained opposition to the marriage means that she surely believed she could win the day. It was extraordinary, unprecedented, for Agatha to go against Clara's counsel, but she was so deep in desire that the mother she adored was almost ignored. Her guilt at this periodically showed itself, as when, for instance, she broke off with Archie on account of Clara's failing eyesight. It was easy, though, for Archie to talk her round with reassurances. Clara could only look on and hope that the delays outlasted the passion. Her misgivings were not just about her own jealousy or even Archie's lack of money. Nobody knew Agatha as Clara did. She knew her innocence, her childlike confidence in love, her dangerous intensity of affection, and she believed that her deep emotional capacity should be left unplumbed, fulfilled only in the realm of imagination. Was she right? It is never a mistake to marry a man you want to marry, even if you regret it, Agatha would later write. But such a thing is easily said and less easily endured. She also wrote this in a letter to her second husband. Mere love is rather an idiotic business, approved of by nature, but capable of inflicting a lot of unhappiness on individuals. As always, she was honestly uncertain. Years after her marriage had ended, the artist in Agatha would continue to ponder the mystery of it. Certainly, she would have been spared a vast amount of anguish had she allowed Clara to prevail against Archie. She would, though, have missed much else beside. Things of incalculable value. In her last Westmacott novel, The Burden, she describes how the protective older sister, Laura, tries with all her might to dissuade Shirley from marrying a man who will hurt her. Yet Shirley would not have lived without that love for all the misery it brings her. "I think he's utterly selfish and ruthless," says Laura to her clever old friend, Mr. Baldock.
"I shouldn't wonder if you weren't right," he replies.
"Well, then?"
"Yes, but she likes the fellow, Laura. She likes him very much. In fact, she's crazy about him. Young Henry mayn't be your cup of tea, and strictly speaking, he isn't my cup of tea. But there's no doubt that he is Shirley's cup of tea."
Later, Shirley accuses Laura of jealousy. "You don't want me to love anyone but you," she says. "You'll never want me to marry anyone." And she takes on Laura's accusation of Henry's ruthlessness. "It's one of those things that attracts me in him." Agatha would never have said or thought any of this at the time. As always in the Westmacotts, she is uncovering the perceptions that had lain within, understood in a way that went beneath acknowledgement. "Don't worry about Henry," Shirley says to Laura. "He loves me," which is what Agatha undoubtedly believed back in 1913, and rightly so, although 40 years later she realized that love was not so simple. "Love?" thought Laura. "What is love? Not an immutable entity, as Agatha had once thought, but the possession of two separate people, who, however much they love each other, have a different capacity for feeling." Meanwhile, Clara clung to the hope that this was not love, but love's first flash in youth, as Lancelot says to Elaine. Again, might she have been right? Elaine dies of love, but it is absurd that she does so. She did not know Lancelot. She could not really have loved him. Normality could have broken through and told her that this was illusion, nothing but illusion, as Agatha later wrote as Mary Westmacott. The illusion that mutual attraction between man and woman breeds. Nature's lure, nature's last and most cunning piece of deceit. But Elaine's imaginative capacity was such that this for her was love, and the pressure of Tennyson's poetic world ensures that escape is not possible, that youthful passion must push itself towards a fateful intensity. Thus, in 1913, when opposition to the marriage, rupture and reunion made the love between Agatha and Archie ever more precious and necessary. And the following year, when the thick feel of death in the air, terrible and almost glamorous, helped twine love so tight around Agatha's soul that she would never quite be free of it. "So this was love, then. I do really love you," wrote Archie to Agatha. "No one else would be the same to me. Never desert me, darling, and always love me." His letters were kept in one of the leather cases in the chest of drawers at Greenway House, the case marked with Agatha's initials, which, among other things, contained the notebook in which Archie recorded the events of his life, his Royal Flying Corps badge, and a card sent from No. 3 Squadron, Netheravon, Wiltshire, on which he had written,
To Miss Miller, in memoriam, Christmas 1912. There was also a photograph of Archie, in uniform, on the back of which Agatha had written, There shall no evil happen unto thee, neither shall any plague. When war broke out, it was as Agatha said in Unfinished Portrait, War for most women is the destiny of one person. She did not notice the curtain fall upon the world she had known. The afternoons on croquet lawns, the tea tables, and picture hats casting their shadows, the scent of rose in the air. Simply she knew that the man she loved was going to France and might never come back. Thus the hot, sultry summer of 1914 ended for Agatha on the 3rd of August when she and Clara took a train journey to Salisbury to say goodbye to Archie, who left for France 9 days later. Dermot in khaki, a different Dermot, very jerky and flippant, with haunted eyes. No one knows about this new war. It's the kind of war where no one might come back. New engines of destruction. The air. Nobody knows about the air. Celia and Dermot were two children clinging together. Agatha had moved from her bedroom window at Ashfield down the steep hill of Barton Road towards the gleaming bay of Torquay. She had tripped on her high heels to garden parties, house parties, racing parties. She had wandered through the sunlit gardens and dark forests of her imagination. Beyond that, there was nothing, and she had felt the need for nothing. She had smiled and tongued her hair, danced and dreamed, and that life was all the life there was. The campaign for women's suffrage, the birth of the Labour Party, Lloyd George and his People's Budget, the Parliament Act which rendered the House of Lords essentially impotent, the movements of the great imperial powers like lumbering chess pieces on a vast board. These passed over her. A murdered Archduke, a war scare in the newspapers, such things barely entered her consciousness. Through her father, the haunted look she had seen in his eyes when the family returned from France at the end of the century, she had felt the first intimations that told her society was changing, that it would no longer be owned by the leisured, the easeful, and disengaged. But she was never a political animal. She absorbed the world by more instinctive means. No civilized nations went to war, was the thinking of the time, as she wrote in her autobiography, until, all of a sudden, they did. And Agatha, whose life up to that point had been wrapped as tenderly as a baby in its swaddling, was dropped like a stone into this stark new world. As ever, the Westmacotts lay bare the fear she had felt, without expressing it at the time. Oh God, let him come back to me. Meanwhile, the autobiography shows the Agatha who could face facts squarely. It describes the dreadful parting with Archie at Salisbury. I remember going to bed that night and crying until I thought I would never stop. But then passes on to describe her hurrying off, full of energy, to begin service as a VAD in Torquay. The impression of a young girl taking her changed circumstances in her stride, uncomplaining and unquestioning. This is reinforced by the recorded interview that Agatha gave, in vibrant old age, to the Imperial War Museum. I thought, oh well, I'd like to become a VAD, and so I started off on that. I was engaged then to the young man who became my first husband, and he had just been accepted in the RAF, in fact, the RFC, so that I felt, you know, mixed up in it completely and wanted to have a part in it. More than 50 years' distance lent a degree of objectivity to Agatha's spoken reminiscences of the war. Nevertheless, she described her nursing duties in a peculiarly realistic, pragmatic way. It is hard to grasp that this girl had emerged from so utterly protected a life that she had gone with such a lack of fuss from her silly, jolly garden parties into the death-centred hospital wards. Of course, no other kind of behaviour would have occurred to her. What had to be. Only Mary Westmacott thought to cry out in protest. On attending her first operation, for example, Agatha described in the Imperial War Museum recording how she began to shake all over. And Sister Anderson took me outside and she said, "Now listen to me. You know what really makes you feel faint is the fact that you're going into an atmosphere of ether. You can't help but feel faint. But everything in life one gets used to. Look in a different place, at somebody else's toe. And in the end, that will be quite all right." Similarly with amputations, I went into one or two. If there had been an amputation and there had been things lying around, the legs or the arms, some of the youngest girls had to take these things down and put them in the furnace. One of those girls, aged around 11, had been grievously upset, although she got all right by the end. So Agatha helped her clean up the floor down there and stuck it in the furnace myself. There are so many odd things that you have to do in hospital. So complex was Agatha that despite her extreme sensitivity, she could take the necessary attitude towards nursing. Efficient, sensible, kindly, detached, and enjoy what she was doing. After the war, she said that she would have liked very much to become a nurse, and might have done so had she not got married. "I would have been very good at it." Again, she suffered none of the frustrations shown in Vera Brittain's Testament of Youth, which portrays VAD work as innately, pointlessly horrific. Wasting one's own life, looking after young men whose lives had been wasted. Agatha conversely saw nursing as very satisfactory. She did her duty smilingly. She found humour in her days, in the love letters that she helped her young men to write to their girlfriends. They usually had three. And in the trips to the X-ray unit at the other hospital across town. They said to me, "Mind you keep an eye on your little bunch when you take them out. You do realize what they're looking for, don't you?" And I said, "Well, what are they looking for? One of them was looking at shoes." "That wouldn't have been next door but one to the Goat and Compass." I said, "Well, I think there was a public house." They learned very soon where all the pubs were. If she was tormented by the wreckage, the beautiful boys with their missing limbs, the dirt and blood and phlegm, she did not say so. She must have been shocked, not least because she was plunged into intimacy with male bodies at a time when, as a young virgin, her knowledge of men would have derived from reproductions of Michelangelo's David. Suddenly, she was dealing with bedbaths and bedpans. There was a special thing, you know, that they pushed on that. And because she had a fiancé, was regarded as sufficiently worldly to handle the more harrowing tasks. They said, "It's better for you because you're married." I said, "No, I'm not married yet." But they said, "It's better, really." The fact is that nobody could have been more innocent than the Agatha of late summer 1914. And she dealt with it easily, that sudden transition into reality. In some mysterious way, she remained untouched by it. "Stella stood meekly by the side of Sister," she wrote in a fragment of an early unfinished novel. Her hands, freshly scrubbed, held a pile of sterilized dressings. What would it be like, Stella wondered, to have someone belonging to you out there? Most girls had, she supposed. She herself was one of the exceptions. She had been studying music in Paris when war broke out. Stella was a solitary creature. Her mind fed on itself to a large extent. She read a great deal and thought profoundly. She was serious, with the pathetic earnest seriousness of the young. For all that she saw and experienced, Agatha still lived in her dreams. In Unfinished Portrait, she does not work as a VAD but stays at home looking after her grandmother. Margaret Miller did come to live at Ashfield, having almost lost her sight, and remembering her imaginary childhood friends. How to keep herself from thinking of Dermot, out there. In desperation, she married off the girls. Isabella married a rich Jew, Elsie married an explorer, Ella became a schoolteacher. Of course, the real Agatha grew up a great deal. walking every day to the hospital, set up in the old town hall, hearing every day of the death of some former dance partner, wondering every day if this would be Archie's last, making the long, lonely walk home to Ashfield, either heavy with thoughts or plagued by rather drunken soldiers. My grandmother didn't like it. Not at all suitable, she said. You ought to have someone to come down and meet you and chaperone you. I said, well, they can't spare anyone to do things like that. It was a desperate time for Agatha, yet she did not feel it as entirely desperate. Eventually it would be over, and her world restored. Not the world around her, that she knew would be changed, but her world. As long as she was young and pretty, as long as Archie was writing letters of adoration, as long as Ashfield bloomed safe and home to Clara, then life would still be Agatha's plaything. Like Nell Vereker in Giant's Bread, who becomes a VAD, she would still be Nell, Nell with her golden hair and her sweet smile. Nell marries Vernon Dare just after the outbreak of war. Lots of girls were doing it, flinging up everything, marrying the man they cared for, no matter how poor he was. After the war, something would turn up. That was the attitude. And behind it lay that awful secret fear that you never took out and looked at properly. The nearest you ever got to it was saying defiantly, "And no matter what happens, we'll have had something." And so Agatha married Archie on Christmas Eve 1914. He was on his first leave, and Agatha told Clara that she thought now was the time to get married. Clara, no doubt recognizing that control had been wrested from her by circumstances, she supported Agatha's VAD work, for instance, said that she would feel exactly the same in Agatha's situation. It was Archie this time who was against the idea. He was flippant, which Agatha failed to realize was his way of dealing with fear, and fed her what was then the RFC line on marriage. You stop one, you've had it, and you've left behind a young widow, perhaps a child coming. It's selfish and wrong. Agatha did not care for this, nor did she care for Archie's Christmas present to her. Not a ring or even any kind of jewelry, but a luxuriously impersonal dressing case, which she refused, somewhat hysterically, to accept. Then, on the night of 23rd of December, everything changed again. Archie strode assertively into her bedroom at Peg Hemsley's house in Bristol, where they were staying for Christmas, and said that they must get married the next day. "I've changed my mind." It frightened Agatha a little, this sudden decisiveness of Archie's, the way it could override a different view of which he had previously been equally sure.
But you were so certain.
What does that matter? I've changed my mind. The following day was exciting, unnerving, a confused rush upon fate. The marriage seemed impossible. Peg wailed in horror at the idea. Nobody could perform the ceremony without notice, and all of this made Agatha and Archie all the more determined to do it. Finally, they were married in Archie's local parish church at a cost of £8 for the license. Agatha wore her street clothes. The music was played by an organist who happened to be practicing. The witness was a friend who, in what must have seemed a benign coincidence, was passing the church at the time. "It made us both laugh," wrote Agatha, of this odd wedding. She told Clara about it only when it was over. The news was accepted, as of course it had to be, and in the light of Peg's reaction, it was agreed that Agatha and Archie would spend Christmas Day at Ashfield after their one night of honeymoon. It was late by the time they took a train to Torquay. Agatha held her new dressing case in one hand, Archie's hand in the other, as she walked the few yards from the station to the Grand Hotel, perched high above the seafront, overlooking the calm, dark bay. Christmas was a happy day spent with Clara and Madge, who had been furious with Agatha over her bombshell. "You are absolutely unfeeling," but got over it. On Boxing Day, Agatha went to London with Archie, there to say goodbye to him for another 6 months before returning to the hospital, and a good deal of teasing from her patients. I heard some little knot of soldiers saying, "Well, I think Miss Miller's done very well for herself. She's married an officer in the RFC. Archie went back to France. His notebook logged his movements throughout the war, beginning 2nd of August, first day of mobilization. Dined in Salisbury on the 3rd and 4th. Then, 21st of December, went on first leave. 24th, to Bristol, later Torquay. 26th, back to London. 30th, went to 1st Wing headquarters." This was the controlled side of Archie, who, like Major Despard, in Cards on the Table, decisively crossing out his bridge scores as he goes, likes to know at a glance where he stands at every moment. There was another Archie, though, fragile and childlike, who touched Agatha's soul in a way that was not maternal, but something more complex and poetical. Later in the war he wrote to her, "Back again. The train journey was all right. I lay dazed in my corner. I got here about 5, had a cup of tea at the county cottage, and am facing war now. I feel weak as a kitten, but we'll go to bed straight after dinner. I'm sure you don't know, my darling, how I love the way you cheered me up, especially yesterday. If I had not had you, I should have quite broken down. Write often. I would have loved to have found a letter here from you tonight." In Giant's Bread, Nell wears Vernon's wartime letters against her heart. The indelible pencil came off on her skin. So Archie's words had rubbed into Agatha's beneath her crisp VAD uniform. "It was so wonderful, so very wonderful to be loved." And Archie did love her. "I love you much too much, more than ever now, to take any risks, for death only means to me being separated from you." He loved her air of unassailable serenity, her sweet voice, her long pale hair, and cool fresh slimness. He loved the way she held his hands when he stretched them out towards her like a lost little boy. He felt that she understood the Archie who lay beneath the Clifton head of school, the glamorous officer pilot. She knew his weak stomach and poor nerves, his neediness, his fear. She would always be there to help him. The letters sent before the war show Archie's innate vulnerability. "My dearest angel," he wrote in March 1914, from his RFC base in Netheravon. "Your letter and the violets were most consoling, though I am still unhappy inwardly, despite the fact that I have finished a bottle of tonic since you finished the dregs of the last bottle. You are full of pluck and courage." Later he asked Agatha, "What I want most is a letter from you to say you are quite well and not worried about all this flying." This was to reassure Archie himself, of course, that he had nothing to worry about. More than obviously he did photographs of his Cody biplane, show it as insubstantial as one of the houses that Poirot would later build from a deck of cards, but the pragmatist in him was still determined on success in a piloting career. "For your sake, more than for my own, I am taking no risks and feel perfectly confident that no harm can come to me. That poor fellow who was killed was not safe in any machine. He hated flying the Cody, but did not like to refuse when he was asked to, showing a lack of moral courage. I am terribly sorry for his family, so much so that I will give up the Corps if you are really very unhappy about it, but I know I am perfectly safe. I always carry St. Christopher with me." Before the war, Agatha was not, according to her autobiography, particularly worried about Archie's job. "Flying was dangerous, but then so was hunting, and I was used to people breaking their necks in the hunting field." This may have been true, but at the same time Agatha had a rather self-conscious attitude towards physical risk. She thought it aristocratic to take it on. She liked the idea of Archie as a daredevil. It was grand. It was as it should be. "That disposition to take risks is what she admired most about Dermot," she wrote in Unfinished Portrait. "He was not afraid of life. She always attacked the bourgeois doctrine of safety first. In my opinion, all the people who spend their lives avoiding being run over by buses had much better be run over and put safely out of the way. They're no good. And she applied this philosophy to women, the best kind, as well as to men. She herself had gone up in an aeroplane at an exhibition in 1911, when planes were crashing every day. Her books, particularly the early ones, are full of girls who show class by refusing to show fear. Just a moment she paused, then, with a little gallant toss of the head, the same toss of the head with which her ancestors had gone into action in the Crusades, she passed through. But for all this, Archie's letters show that Agatha did worry about his flying. How could she not? "There is no machine for me to fly at present. Don't say hurrah or words to that effect, because I am going to take more care than ever now," he wrote to her from Netheravon. He continued with an expression of his own concern. "Do take care of yourself. You hate being told this, I know, but you are so very precious to me that I can't bear to think of you being ill or unhappy or wanting anything you could possibly have." In fact, Archie hated the realities of misery, as he had told her early on in their relationship. "It spoils everything for me." Because of this, Clara had feared his lack of consideration, his ruthlessness. "But he was not ruthless to her," Celia says of herself in Unfinished Portrait, thinking how wrong her mother had been. "He was young, diffident, very much in love, and Celia was his first love." The first leave after the wedding, logged in Archie's notebook, July 1915, London, was naturally a letdown. Too much pressure on too little time made relaxation impossible. "It was like some queer, delirious dream," wrote Agatha of the same situation in Giant's Bread. They were in some ways like strangers to each other. He was offhand when she spoke about France. It was all right. Everything was all right. One made jokes about it and refused to treat it seriously. When he asked her what she had been doing, she could only give him hospital news, and that he didn't like. He begged her again to give it up. "It's a filthy job, nursing. I hate to think of your doing it." This was not entirely Archie's view. He did not interfere to that extent in Agatha's business, but he probably liked to think of her as a precious dream of home, untouched by war. The open-hearted girl who at the start of the year had sent him the AA alphabet for 1915. A is for Angel by nature and name, and also for Archibald, spouse of the same. B is his bath, most important of matters. Z is for the zest of that wonderful pair, the Archibald Christies, who make their bow here. Her heartrending lack of embarrassment was matched by Archie's in 1916, when he sent to Agatha an analysis of her character by, as he called himself, the Omniscient One. "A kindly and affectionate disposition, fond of animals except worms and cockchafers, fond of human beings except husbands, on principle. Normally lazy but can develop and maintain great energy. Sound in limb and eye, wind not good uphill, full of intelligence and artistic taste, unconventional and inquisitive, face good, especially hair, figure good and skin excellent, can wheedle well, wild, but if once captured, would make a loving and affectionate wife." By the time of his first leave, Archie had been seconded into the Royal Field Artillery, where he was promoted to captain. His sinuses, which had played him up from the first and caused intolerable pain in the air, eventually prevented him continuing as a pilot. Later he moved into administration, at which he was able. A 1917 letter described how he was glued to a telephone till 11 p.m. last night, and my temper is not so sweet in consequence. "I sentenced a man to 28 days of what the Daily Mirror used to call crucifixion, that is, being tied to a tree and undergoing other punishments and fatigue, because he refused to work, went absent without leave, and pretended to be sick when he was not. The only person I care about today is you, and I do really love you. Never desert me, darling, and always love me." Agatha worried less about Archie when he was no longer flying, probably believing that his sinuses had saved his life. But as one military historian wrote, "The war of 1914 to 1918 was an artillery war. Artillery was the battle winner. Artillery was what caused the greatest loss of life, the most dreadful wounds, and the deepest fear." And Archie was a determined soldier, as his record shows. His notebook logged his promotions, etc., which included being mentioned in dispatches 4 times by General Sir John French in October 1914, receiving a DSO and the Order of St. Stanislaus, 3rd class. "So beautiful, I would have liked to have worn it myself," wrote Agatha, and ending the war as a colonel. He had been through it, in other words. But when he came home in September 1918, a little early because he had been posted to the Air Ministry, he was alive and sound and apparently the same as ever. For Agatha, it was a simple miracle. Oh, the ovation that husbands receive from affectionate wives when they come home on leave. She did not need or want to think about it. Only after the Second World War, with which she was far less intensely engaged, did she consider what the first had actually meant to men like Archie. Taken at the Flood, 450 from Paddington, and the Westmacott novel The Rose and the Yew Tree ponder the question of the soldier's post-war life. The fiercely tormented David Hunter, the lost boy Brian Eastley, the charming pragmatist John Gabriel. They were all created by Agatha after 1945, and they all have something of Archie in them. They all knew what it was like to sleep and wake with death, to live with it as intimately as with a wife, then come home to a world that expects them to return gratefully to their former selves. By then, Agatha understood the terrible energy that these men carried with them. In 1918, she had scarcely a clue. Her creation, Captain Hastings, had been invalided home in The Mysterious Affair at Stiles, but in fact the war had scant appearance in the book. Agatha wrote it in 1916 between Archie's leaves and her hospital work. That she should have done so is a great and glorious mystery in itself. But there it is, out of almost nowhere, almost the complete article. One can explain it up to a point. Agatha had been writing all her life. She had already completed a novel, Snow Upon the Desert, which hinted at the themes of her detective fiction, although it was poorly structured, which augured badly. She had enjoyed Gaston Leroux's The Mystery of the Yellow Room, Poe's The Murders in the Rue Morgue, LeBlanc's Arsène Lupin stories, and of course Conan Doyle. The genre was modish in the early 20th century, so it is perhaps not so hard to imagine that a clever girl might have a shot at it. And then there was the factor of Madge, always a thorn in Agatha's competitive side. According to the autobiography, the sisters had discussed the recently published The Mystery of the Yellow Room, and Agatha had said she would like to write a detective story, to which Madge replied that she too had thought of doing so, and did not believe that Agatha could pull it off. "I should like to try." "Well, I bet you couldn't." LaRue's novel was published in 1908, so if this was indeed how the seed was sown in Agatha, it waited 8 years before flowering. But in all probability, this was the starting point. To do something that Madge could not, how sweet that would be. Then there was the job at the Torquay dispensary, which kicked Agatha's imagination to a new and more decided place. After a bad bout of flu in 1916, she found on her return to the hospital that a dispensary had opened, with her friend Eileen Morris in joint charge. It seemed sensible to take a job there, on a salary of £16 per annum, as the hours were shorter than on the wards, and as Agatha's home duties were considerable. Her grandmother was quite a handful, and there were now only 2 elderly maids in the house. In fact, she preferred nursing to dispensing. Eileen's organized and scholarly brain left Agatha way behind when it came to the theory of chemistry, and in 1917 she received just 50 out of 100, average, in her practical pharmacy exam with the Society of Apothecaries in London. But dispensing, for all that Agatha found its principles elusive and its practice monotonous, interested her in other ways. The people interested her. She immediately saw that doctors prescribed according to their own ideas rather than the individual needs of their patients. Her books were often unflattering to doctors. She had seen too much of them to be impressed. And she was appalled, although again fascinated, by the arrogant little talky pharmacist who made a serious error, misplacing a decimal point, in Agatha's presence. She knew he would refuse to acknowledge this, so what was the young student to do? I was the merest novice. He was the best-known pharmacist in town. I couldn't say to him, "Mr. P, you have made a mistake." Mr. P, the pharmacist, was the sort of person who does not make a mistake. In the end, Agatha pretended to stumble and upset the tray of suppositories that Mr. P had made so toxic, then squashed them firmly with her shoes. "That's all right, little girl," said the pharmacist, patting her shoulders tenderly, as was his horrible habit. "I had to put up with it because I was being instructed," wrote Agatha in her autobiography, an interesting throwaway. This man, who carried a lump of curare in his pocket because it made him feel powerful, reappeared more than 40 years later in her book The Pale Horse, transmuted into the chemist Mr. Osborne. What she also absorbed was the fascination of poison, the beautiful look of the bottles, the exquisite precision of the calculations, the potential for mayhem contained within order. The original idea for The Mysterious Affair at Stiles was a method for murder. It came from Agatha's dispensing work and could not have come to her otherwise, as it entirely depends upon a knowledge of poisons. In fact, it is impossible to reach the solution to Stiles without this knowledge. The reader may guess right as to the culprit, but the guess cannot be proved without knowledge of the properties of strychnine and bromide. But Agatha's first detective novel was, in a sense, her only cheat. But as it is in every other way so typical, so instinctively marked with her particular genius, so nearly the finished article, this seems to have gone unremarked. Right from the start, she realized the potential of the idea that she would always use to such effect, that of fastening suspicion so firmly to one person that the reader eliminates him or her, only to find that here indeed is the culprit. She deployed this device, as no other writer has since, with the utmost logic and liberality. The murderer is absent from the scene of the crime, as in Stiles, or appears to be the intended victim, or is the narrator of the story, or a person incapacitated by a gunshot wound, or is a child, or a policeman. The key with Agatha being that blessed element of the ordinary, which gives the device an illusion of reality. That she has a gift for plotting coups was undeniable. The genre had a magical effect upon her ability to structure, although this was not achieved without a great deal of work, which interested her in the manner of wrestling with an intricate mathematical equation, as she had done as a child with her father. But plot for Agatha meant distillation of character. It did not exist in a vacuum. It is not enough that the husband in Stiles should be suspected because he is sinister and rejected as a suspect because he has an impregnable alibi. What lies at the root of her solution is character, the truth about men who marry rich elderly wives. It was the people who interested her always. Human nature. That, I think, is perhaps the real answer to why I am interested in this case, as Poirot later said. Clara, of course, was unsurprised when Agatha told her what she was doing. Why not a detective story? What couldn't her girls do? It was Clara who told Agatha to go away to Dartmoor for her fortnight's holiday and finish the book quite undisturbed. She wrote all morning, then in the afternoons tramped the moors blissfully, becoming one character after another as she muttered dialogue out loud. This became a lifelong habit. My sister used occasionally to say to me, "You really look like an idiot walking along the street talking to yourself," Agatha recalled in an interview in 1974. But when you first start to think out a book, the nicest thing to do is to go for a long walk somewhere. The Mysterious Affair at Styles, I wrote going along and talking as I went. You can't do anything until you have thought of the characters and you can feel that they are real to you. Not necessarily to anyone else, but to you. And you can go walking about the garden with them. Chief among the characters of Styles, and central thereafter to Agatha Christie's life, an additional husband of sorts, albeit demanding in a very different way, was Hercule Poirot. The mythical Belgian, with his fanatical neatness, his egg-shaped head, his grey cells and ink-black moustache. Unreal, unbelievable, yet mysteriously alive from the moment of his eruption onto the page, and with that indefinable literary quality of connection with the reader. This was Agatha's writerly instinct in action, pure, unteachable, defiant of analysis. She herself did not really know how she had come to create this extraordinary little being. In her autobiography, she tried rather helplessly to elucidate the thought processes that were the building blocks of Poirot. "I remembered our Belgian refugees. Why not make my detective a Belgian?" I thought. Anyway, I settled on a Belgian detective. Hercule. Hercule Poirot. That was all right. Settled, thank goodness. Quite possibly her thoughts had run very much along these lines, but in the end this does not explain why they did so, why other thoughts were rejected along the way, and the right thoughts alighted upon. This is the mystery of creativity, after all. Far less creative was the relationship between Poirot and his friend Captain Hastings, which is straightforwardly that of Holmes and Watson, and downright harmless theft. But Poirot so less resembles Holmes only in his absolute individuality. Both characters are like fabulous line drawings, always themselves and always recognizable. Provenance can be pondered, but is in the end almost meaningless. Doubtless fashion led Agatha to make Poirot a foreigner, like Poe's Dupin or Leroux's Rouletabille. And it has been said that he was created in direct imitation of Marie Belloc Lowndes' Hercule Poirot. The name hints again at larceny, but the characters were not alike. More similar was the conceited Eugene Valmont, who appeared in stories in the early 20th century. A would-be biographer, who made a polite nuisance of himself in the 1960s, suggested to Agatha that Poirot might have been part inspired by Robert Barr's creation, to which she replied, "I think nothing of Valmont." Significance has been found in Poirot's physical resemblance to a dandified Satan, in the fact that Agatha, the lover of food, gave him a name so similar to the French word for leek, Poirot, and in a good deal else besides, this being the kind of benign madness that surrounds celebrity of the magnitude achieved by Poirot. The strange and beautiful truth is that he was created in a way that not even his creator perfectly understood. A felicitous stew of things she had heard, things she had read, things she remembered, things she invented, mixed and dreamed in the spaces of Agatha's life among the medicine bottles of the Torquay dispensary, along the uphill roads to Ashfield, over the Devon Moors. And although Poirot would develop, acquiring certain depths as and when Agatha felt the need of them, he is true to his own creed of character, in that he never really changed. Here he is, scuttling neatly around Styles Court in Essex, a county of which Agatha knew next to nothing, utterly and instantly himself, although at this point he needed the wretched Hastings to show it. "We have found in this room," he said, writing busily, "6 points of interest. Shall I enumerate them, or will you?" "Oh, you," I replied hastily. And, "It is certainly curious," I agreed. "Still, it is unimportant and need not be taken into account." A groan burst from Poirot. "What have I always told you? Everything must be taken into account. If the fact will not fit the theory, let the theory go." The moment in the book when Poirot's shaking hands mechanically straighten a pair of candlesticks in which a vital piece of evidence had been hurriedly hidden, hence the crookedness, is essence of Christie. There is no mere clue. Its unearthing is absolutely rooted in Poirot's obsession with symmetry. At her very first attempt, Agatha had understood, or intuited, that a clue based upon character has double the value. She also gave Poirot the rather charming sexlessness that allows him to be wise in a manner that is almost feminine, albeit disinterested in a way that women rarely manage to be. Here, for example, he responds as Hastings clunks his way to the wrong conclusion.
"I happen to know for a fact that far from being in love with her, he positively dislikes her."
"Who told you that, mon ami?"
"Cynthia herself."
"La pauvre petite. And she was concerned?"
"She said that she did not mind at all."
"Then she certainly did mind very much," remarked Poirot. "They are like that, les femmes."
The original ending of the book, scrawled in excitable pencil in one of Agatha's many writing notebooks, all of which were kept at Greenway House, shows the naivety she had hitherto kept so admirably at bay. Perhaps for the last time she is back in the amateur land of Snow Upon the Desert, writing a court scene in which Poirot gives the entire solution of the murder in the form of sensational evidence. M. Le Juge. The temperature that day was 86 in the shade. Read it, M. Le Juge, for it is a letter from the murderer. All of the lines that would later appear in the revised version of Styles are written as dialogue between Poirot and the court judge. Impeccably worked out, absolutely unfeasible. I think in Styles I wrote a court scene out of my head which just could never have taken place, she said much later. It was a minor flaw. In every other way the book was supremely sophisticated, not least in its blithe treatment of marital boredom. Without feeling the need to moralize or even comment, Agatha presented a couple, John and Mary Cavendish, whose love for each other is foundering on his dalliance with a pretty village gypsy and her somber flirtation with Dr. Bauerstein.
"I have had enough of the fellow hanging about. He's a Polish Jew, anyway," says John,
to which Mary replies, "A tinge of Jewish blood is not a bad thing. It leavens the..." She looked at him. "The stolid stupidity of the ordinary Englishman." Hastings himself is half in love with Mrs. Cavendish, loathes Bauerstein on this account, and seeks at every turn to be in a married woman's company. This, too, is presented as normal behaviour. 20 years of listening to the worldly whispers of Margaret Miller had done their work. But Agatha, like many writers before and since, was more astute in her art than in her life, and saw a good deal more clearly with the eyes of her mind. According to her autobiography, she showed the mysterious affair at Styles to Archie, who liked it very much, and encouraged her to send it to a publisher. They had not seen each other, she wrote, for 2 years since that first unsatisfactory leave in July 1915, when he was so nervy and she so tense. This time, all was happiness. They went to the New Forest for a week. We walked together through the woods and had a kind of companionship that we had not known before. Archie said that he wanted to follow the path that led to no man's land, so they did. It took them to an orchard full of apples, which they ate as they wandered through the trees. All around and below her were trees, trees whose leaves were turning from gold to brown. It was a world incredibly golden and splendid in the strong autumn sunlight. Henrietta thought, "I love autumn. It's so much richer than spring." And suddenly, one of those moments of intense happiness came to her, a sense of the loveliness of the world, of her own intense enjoyment of that world. She thought, "I shall never be as happy again as I am now. Never." She stayed there a minute, gazing out over that golden world that seemed to swim and dissolve into itself, hazy and blurred with its own beauty. In fact, Agatha had remembered it wrong. As Archie's notebook makes clear, the New Forest leave was in October 1915, before she had even begun to write Styles, and there was at no time a separation of 2 years during the war. This, though, was how she had remembered that particular week. One of the oddest things in life, I think, is the things one remembers. One chooses to remember, I suppose. Something in one must choose.